Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me out here. I mean, it is such a reality that I find it hard to find my way out here. The last time I came out this way, Fitzroy Football Club still played occasional games at Waverley Park, and it's changed a lot. But one of the things that you do notice, and one of the things that we know about this part of Melbourne, is its incredible diversity. I know that as a historian. I've been teaching writing for 10 years, but before that I taught history at the University of Melbourne. And my wife, in fact, is a historian also, and most of the work that she does is on migration. And she's an English girl herself who came out with her parents in the 1980s, and since then she's looked at British migration to Australia, but then, of course, in recent years looked at the incredible diversity of migration from all over the world in this part of Melbourne. And it is wonderful. It is wonderful to see that diversity represented in the audience that you attend. The other thing which was brought up is about my point about what sort of conversation we have, even though it is marketed as, and described as a lecture. It will be, in fact, some of this I want to deliver formally so that we get a clear sense of the person I'm going to talk about as part of this conversation. But to me, all of these events are conversations, and I'm not here to lecture to people, but to give you a set of ideas that I hope that you might respond to. Essentially, what I want to do is I want to talk about the power of writing quite specifically as it applied to Aboriginal people from the mid-19th century onwards into the 20th century of Victoria by looking at a very particular case study of the incredible struggle of one woman and how she used writing to struggle for her survival and the survival of her family. Part of this impetus for this was brought about when I was working as a historian. There is an infamous piece of legislation that was enacted in the colony of Victoria in 1886, an act called the Aborigines Act in a benign way, but it's an act more commonly known by Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people as the Half-Caste Act. And it was a piece of legislation that attempted to separate out Aboriginal families according to biological caste. And in fact, when it was first instituted in 1886, the stated objective of the act was to separate older so-called full-blood Aboriginal people from younger so-called half-caste or mixed-blood Aboriginal people. Now, if that wasn't insidious enough, what you're talking about, in fact, is the separation of children from their parents. So we're talking about in the 1880s, often teenagers or young adults who are being told that they're being recast, recategorised as white people, and that they must leave missions and reserves and not reside on those places where their parents, in fact, can't leave. So you've got a situation where one generation of Aboriginal people are incarcerated in these reserves and a second generation of Aboriginal people are, in fact, told to leave the reserves. And what I'm going to do, and I'll introduce her in a moment, is talk about a woman who epitomises the struggle of many women in particular to subvert and to present an opposition to that legislation. Just a bit of a sort of a preamble so that we can contextualise this and put it into a historical context is that the reason I use the term the power of writing is quite explicit. In 1865, many Aboriginal people were forced onto one of the very early reserves, which was the Corindick Reserve outside of Hillsville, which people may know, which is relatively at least over this side of the city. And once placed on that reserve in the early 1860s, children were separated from their parents and put into a dormitory system where they were given for the first time formal education in English. And of course, it was the basics of reading, writing, arithmetic, etc. And the stated objective at the time was that if we can take these children away from their savage culture, we can give them an education in British European ways, and that will civilise them and uplift them to a European standard. By the early 1880s, those children are older teenagers or the young adults that were separated or attempted separation from their families under the Act. Now, just before the Act was instituted, and it's clear that this was a lot of the motivation behind the Act, is that these young adults were the ones who were agitating for Aboriginal rights in the first instance. They were agitating for rights for themselves, for their families, for their parents, and their communities. And the Reverend Bulmer, who at the time was the manager of the Lake Tyers Reserve in Gippsland in the east of the state, wrote to the Chief Secretary of the Colony of Victoria and said, the greatest mistake we have ever made with these people was to give them the power of writing. And he went on to say that to give these children the power of writing, they have used it as a poison pen against us. So rather than writing becoming something that these young people would learn to understand diligence and their subordinated place in the world, they used it to understand and demand the value of human rights, which is what we're here to talk about tonight. And one of the things I'd like to say as a historian and working in this area for quite some time is that although we often find that human rights are eventually granted by government, so we might have human rights legislation, although at present in Australia it seems very difficult for a federal parliament to understand the value of human rights, is that human rights always comes at the end of a very long struggle by people who push for that demand. So my interest is not so much on the eventual outcomes of when government legislate to grant human rights, but what I would call the daily struggle for human rights articulated in this case by Aboriginal people. And the second point I'd like to make is that that struggle is centrally the struggle, what I call grassroots in the truest sense. I focus most of my research on Aboriginal women, and I think that if you look at what Aboriginal women are doing, it's something that all women would understand, and I hope something that all communities understand. When they're agitating for rights, they're talking about the basics of shelter, they're talking about the basics of food for their children, they're talking about the basics of healthcare, of proper diet, and often we don't understand that these are the essential elements of human rights. Not in Aboriginal society, we focus often on something called land rights or native title, and we know the importance of this. But for me as a historian, I've always looked at what has happened at that local level. And again, the greatest, I think, energised agitators for that have been Aboriginal women. So I'm going to introduce you to one of those women in a moment. And then what we're going to do before we have discussion in the audience, because it's WordFest and I'm a writer, I'm actually going to show you how I decided to use my learning and my training as a historian by looking at these stories. Firstly, as a poet, I publish a lot of poetry as well, and to show you how I use this archival material as a poet, and then to finish with just this very short reading from my novel Blood, to give a sense of what I would call the ethics of being a creative writer and how you, in fact, might draw on historical material and what it means for you to do that. Okay, so what we're going to do is, in a sense, we're going to meet a remarkable woman, a woman who I doubt anyone would have heard of, and I want to say that while she is a remarkable woman, she's not atypical. There are many other cases that I looked at as a historian going to government archives in Victoria and Commonwealth archives where I followed through the campaigns of various women both at places like Corranderk, at places like Lake Tyers in the east and places like Framlingham in the west of Victoria who did the same thing that this wonderful, remarkable woman, Bessie Rawlings, did throughout her life. So in a sense, what I did with these letters is that I began to look at writings from Aboriginal women from the outset of the establishment of the particular reserve they may have been living on and to see, follow them through and to see what responses they received from government and how long they took up this struggle for writing. Two things to know in relationship to this. To understand the very real threat and danger that these women faced by taking up these campaigns. It could often come at great cost. It could come at great cost to their liberty. It could come of having their rations cut. It could come of having the rations for their children cut. And as we know, it could come and did come at having their children removed from them from time to time. They're always under threat from government, and yet these women persisted with remarkable tenacity. And the second thing, of course, and it's part of what we're here for tonight, it shows that in the case of Aboriginal communities in Victoria, the ability to take a technology, the written language, and people always talk about Aboriginal cultures as oral, and while oral culture is absolutely central to all Aboriginal communities across Australia, one of the things that we need to understand about Aboriginal communities is that the ability to take on and adapt new ideas and new technologies to use them to the advantage of the community. And that, to me, is a relative point when you're thinking of libraries. People often ask how I got to where I am. So I'm a university lecturer. I publish, obviously, fiction. I have a PhD in history and a Master of Arts in Creative Writing. I run a creative writing program in the oldest university in the state, but I was expelled from high school twice by the time I was 15 and dropped out of school for the next 15 years. Now, that's not a boast. If people say, well, how did you get back to education? And I, in fact, did my year 12 at a night school at a TAFE college, and it's terrible to see what's happening to TAFE colleges at the moment, in 1987. And I came to university in 1988 and didn't leave. And when people say, well, it must have been difficult for you to get back there, I mean, the most difficult thing was to swallow a bit of pride and turn up. But in fact, what made it manageable was I was always a voracious reader. So even when I was a troublesome teenager, I read all the time. And from when I left school to when I went back to school, I was always reading. And I was always reading because I had a library card. Now, I can go out and buy any book I want to now. I was saying to Julie before, I buy too many books. When I was a kid, there were no books in our house because we couldn't afford books. If my mother had money to spend and had to make a choice, it would be on food. You wouldn't have the luxury of a book, a new book in particular. But we had public libraries. I had a library card, and I always knew I could go into my local library and borrow a book. And I think that if anyone asks me what's the most important institution in any country that sees itself as civil, it is a public library. I walked in and strolled around the library here earlier, and again, you're seeing people from all these diverse backgrounds that were mentioned, reading newspapers in what we might call their mother language, but also reading newspapers in English. And for people who come to this country, and people who have come in the last 70 years from that post-war era, the local library has been absolutely central to their ability to learn a new language, a new culture. And in the case of Bessie Rawlings, it was her ability to take something absolutely foreign to Aboriginal culture and find a way to use it effectively. So Bessie Rawling is a woman who was born and lived on the Framlingham Aboriginal Mission in the Western District of Victoria for most of her life. And basically what I'm going to do is tell her story through her own words to begin with. The Framlingham Aboriginal Reserve in Western Victoria opened in 1861, a year after the formation of the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. The Gunditjmara country surrounding the reserve had witnessed the widespread murder and attempted dispossession of Aboriginal people, and many of the survivors of these battles had been forced to move on to the reserve. Within 2 years of its opening, Framlingham was threatened with closure when the manager, Daniel Clark, resigned after a dispute with Aboriginal people over his attempt to remove children from their families. In the early years of Framlingham's operation, children were sometimes taken from their families and sent away to the nearby Lake Conda Reserve. The colonial government then made it difficult for both immediate family and extended family to remain in contact with their children. Shortly after Clark's resignation, the government decided to scale down the reserve. Farming machinery, along with other equipment that might sustain the land agriculturally, was removed. The Board for the Protection of Aborigines, the BPA, also refused to provide the reserve with a direct managerial role. The BPA had decided that Framlingham would not be required in the future as a result of its proposed concentration policies, whereby most Aboriginal people living in the colony of Victoria would be eventually located at Lake Tyers Reserve in the east of the state at Gippsland. The move had an immediate impact on the community. With the loss of agricultural machinery, the difficulties of farming and attempts at self-sufficiency were obvious. The arbitrary removal of rations to individuals classified as half-caste or simply activist troublemakers also impacted negatively on both community and family structure. In order to gain an understanding into the tenacity of Aboriginal people who battled against the will of the BPA to destroy Framlingham, I want to look at the life of Bessie Rawlings, a Gunditjmara woman born in 1850. Her struggle provides an invaluable insight into the determination of Aboriginal people to strive for rights and the legacy that women such as Bessie left for a generation of activists in the post-war era. Bessie, described as a half-caste woman, first appeared in correspondence between herself and the BPA when she applied for a rail pass to visit her daughters at Melbourne in 1891. The request was denied on behalf of the BPA by the Reverend Frederick Hergenauer. He wrote to Bessie explaining in clear terms the consequences if she went to Melbourne to fetch her daughter home next week, as she had outlined in her request for a rail pass. Hergenauer laid out the facts for Bessie. "You seem to ignore the fact that your daughter is and must be under the regulation of the law, and that if you try to get the girl away, she'll have to go before the court. The fact is, this cannot be done at all as long as you enjoy the receipt of government support. The moment you do so, attempt to get your daughter back, rations and all other support, as well as living on a reserve, must stop. The board cannot break the law of the country." Less than 2 weeks after this refusal to allow Bessie permission to make her own decision about the life of her children, Hergenauer wrote to her a second time, informing her that as her second daughter, now having reached the age required by law, will not receive any further supplies, and it would not be good if you provide a service to her. By this he meant that Bessie should encourage her daughter to be farmed out as domestic labour and not remain with her on the reserve. In the same correspondence, Hergenauer informed Bessie that the supply of meat for Framlinghan has to be discontinued, as the blacks have now got the land, which they did not have. The ongoing exchanges between Hergenauer and the ever-determined Bessie Rawlings in the years following this initial dispute highlight the level of petty control that the BPA held over the lives of the Framlingham community. For instance, in August 1893, Hergenauer gave permission for Bessie's unemployed daughters to receive rations for 4 weeks, but with the understanding that I will not do so in the future. The next month, Bessie wrote to the Reverend Stahl, the manager of the Lake Conda Reserve, asking that her mother be able to visit her. She wrote, "I wish you would please, Mr. Stahl, allow my dear mother to come and spend a few days with me. This is all at present that I request. God bless you all." In the following correspondence between Stahl and Bessie, he granted permission for one of her daughters, Ina, to stay with her grandmother at Lake Conda until Christmas, but she must leave immediately after that date. There was little that Bessie could do or accomplish in her life that did not require permission from the board. The more she defied the board in providing for her children and attempting to keep her family together, the more she suffered the displeasure of the authorities. At one point in April 1897, Hergenauer wrote to Bessie with a clear threat that if she or any other Aboriginal at Framlingham harbour half-castes in their houses, rations and supplies will be stopped. By half-castes, he meant her immediate family members. Further to this threat, Hergenauer wrote in May 1897, informing Bessie that, "In answer to your letter of yesterday, I have to inform you that your son cannot remain any longer on the station." This did not deter her from writing again in October of the same year, asking that both her daughter and granddaughter be able to come and live with her at Framlingham. The request was, not unexpectedly, refused by Hergenauer. His response to Bessie highlights both the mean-spiritedness of the BPA and the complete absence of compassion. He wrote, "I have the honour to inform you that your application to the above board to allow your daughter to stay with you and grant some rations to her, and likewise yourself, 3 bags of seed potatoes and other seeds, has duly been considered at yesterday's meeting, and I am directed to inform you that none of your applications can be granted and no ration will be given to you." Shortly before the birth of the new century, rumours began circulating Framlingham that the residents were to be dispersed or moved to Lake Tyres depending on the classification of their identity. Bessie wrote to the Chief Secretary of Victoria of the colonial government, Mr. Peacock, who, by the way, was Andrew Peacock's grandfather, demanding that she and her family be allowed to remain at their Framlingham home. She wrote, "Dear Sir, my husband wishes me to write to you and ask you, sir, if you know anything about the board talking about shifting us away from here shortly. We would rather live here as we are. I am yours. Please send an answer to me immediately." The board seemed to have had enough of Bessie, and in response to her letter, it demanded that she leave Framlingham as it was to be closed in due course. Bessie refused to move, and the reserve remained occupied by the Framlingham community, living in limbo on land where the government often denied any official jurisdiction while repeatedly intervening in the lives of the residents. Toward the end of the First World War, Bessie can be found writing again to defend her rights. On this occasion, she demanded that instead of the board pocketing her son's military pay while he had enlisted in the AIF, the money should be paid to her, as was the situation with non-Aboriginal families. She wrote, "Dear Sir, this is just a few lines to let you know that I haven't received my military pay yet. You know, sir, that what little rations I get from the board is not worth my dear son's only life, of which he has gone to give up now for king and freedom. See that I get my pay, for you know, sir, that every mother's heart is with her son. God bless our boys at the front." Bessie would face many difficulties in her struggle to remain at the reserve, but none more so than losing the family home to fire in 1919. When William Rawlings, Bessie's husband, left their small cottage one Saturday evening to visit a close friend, John Blair. When William came back home later that night, he discovered the house had burnt to the ground, along with an adjoining building that was used for Sunday service. A resulting campaign to have both a new church building erected and the Rawlings rehoused highlighted the board's resolve to force the family from Framlingham by stealth and to orchestrate a situation whereby the reserve would fall into such a state of disrepair that living there at all would become impossible. Shortly after the fire, a petition was signed by 34 Framlingham residents and 78 local non-Aboriginal people supporting a demand that a new church be erected on the site. While the petition stated that the building was necessary for worship on the Sabbath, the document also reminded the government that the community was determined to remain at Framlingham at all costs and that they were opposed to removal to Loke Tyres. While it is clear that a place of worship was important to the largely Christian Framlingham community, the erection of any new structure on the reserve would also legitimate the community's struggle to retain a home more generally. The BPA addressed this in its subsequent minimal replies to any request at permanent, stating, with standard bureaucratic banality, that it is contrary to the policy of the board to make provisions for any buildings other than that at Lake Tyres, as any expenditure should not be incurred with a view of the proposed disbandment of Framlingham. The board claimed that a key reason driving the concentration policy was that Aboriginal people created trouble within towns located near reserves such as Framlingham that were no longer managed or policed. Although there is evidence of hostility towards Aboriginal people in some country towns, it is also clear that the Framlingham community had strong friends and supporters amongst non-Aboriginal people in towns surrounding the reserve, and a cooperative situation had developed that clearly unnerved the Board for the Protection of Aborigines. I'll just halt there, because one of the issues around reconciliation historically is there have actually been many instances at a local level of great acts of reconciliation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, and you often find governments intervening to stop that interaction because they see it as much more troublesome than something that will unify people. But we can talk about that in the discussion. In a reply to testimony supporting the Framlingham community by non-Aboriginal people, the Chief Secretary argued that the government was only trying to protect the Framlingham community as the location of the reserve allowed Aborigines to fraternise with whites in the nearby town of Warrnambool, a situation that would no longer be tolerated. The BPA wrote, "We do not want them, Aborigines, near big centres. We have seen Lake Tyres and think it is an ideal place for Aborigines. Even if a big population goes to that that district. Lake Tyers is isolated. Clearly, the inference is there. The Chief Secretary also argued that if we were to approve the church building, which the local white community had agreed to pay for, it would symbolise a sense of permanence at Framlingham. And that looks like making it a permanent station, which we are not prepared to do. After the church building had burnt down, services and ceremonies were held in the open air in the middle of a Western District winter. On the 12th of July 1920, a local Baptist minister wrote to Mr. Parker, the secretary of the board, informing him, "Yesterday we had a double burial at the station, old Mrs. Blair and a little boy. It's a pathetic sight. It was awful weather, rough, wet and cold. Outdoor services are almost out of the question now." The board replied in typical dispassion and making no comment on the deaths of either the elder or the boy that the board had finally agreed to erect a new church building. In view of its policy not to erect a permanent building over at Lake Tyers, the structure that decided would be built would be a portable one, so that it, along with the residents of Framlingham, could be removed to Lake Tyers when the need for a church at Framlingham ceases. Following the fire, the local Aboriginal guardian, a police constable Harvey from Warrnambool Station, informed the board that William Rawlings, now this is a man whose own house was burnt down, William Rawlings was now homeless and possessed nothing more than the clothes he stands up in, with the exception of three or four sheets of roof iron that he and Bessie had salvaged from the fire. This is the roof to their hut. Secretary Parker wrote back to Harvey with a stock reply that the Rawlings could not be rehoused at Framlingham, as it was against the policy of the board to erect any new buildings on any station or reserve other than Lake Tyers. It just says this ad nauseum. But additionally, it informed the police constable, although it was not the policy of the board to admit half-castes to Lake Tyers under normal circumstances, it directed Harvey to remove the Rawlings from Framlingham with the incentive that they would be accommodated at Lake Tyers. Parker provided two one-way rail passes to the Rawlings family in an effort to persuade them to make the arduous trip across the state. Another church minister, Reverend Ward, wrote to Parker urging that Mr. and Mrs. Rawlings be permitted to stay at this settlement, as they will be very grieved to leave. And by this stage, Bessie is 70 years old as well. In an effort to provide an understanding of both the emotion of the situation and what he felt were the inherent rights of the Rawlings family, Reverend Ward also informed Parker that the Rawlings' son Charles had been killed in the Great War and he had been awarded the Military Medal for Bravery. In closing, Ward pleaded with Mr. Parker, "It would be sorry to see this couple go so far from their children and grandchildren with the evening of their lives upon them." Still, the board persisted in its attempts to remove the Rawlings family from Framlingham. Now, they had set up a temporary, what we might call a humpy, with those four sheets of iron. So in November 1919, Constable Harvey wrote back to the board, returning the two rail passes, explaining that Bessie had told him that she did not want them and would not leave the reserve. Harvey stated that the Rawlings told him they will forgo any protection, ration, or anything else ordered by the board rather than be forced to move to Lake Tyers. Harvey also sought instruction from Parker as to what to do about a request from Bessie in writing. She had written and asked Harvey that she be allowed to keep the roofing iron salvaged from the fire and to erect a small place to live. Instructively, Harvey additionally informed Parker that the roofing iron, obviously in good condition, was possibly saleable. In other words, they might be able to sell it. Whether Bessie got to turn a humpy into a house or not, we do not know. But what is clear that she and William were sheltered by another family on the reserve. The Chief Secretary then wrote back to Harvey and told him it was an offence for the family to remain in control of the four pieces of iron and that the iron be taken from the family or they be charged with theft. Bessie Rawlings is unknown outside her community. She was a genuine freedom fighter for Aboriginal people. Her story is a story of Aboriginal people throughout history across Australia. Bessie died during the Great Depression in the early 1930s. Her and many women like her toiled away at the kitchen table with pen and paper under the ever-present threat of punishment. We must remember and celebrate such women. Bessie herself remained at Framlingham until her death, where she is buried in the cemetery on land she fought so hard for. Okay. Now again, before we move on to talk about how I've, in a sense, used this in my own work, I just want to again really reiterate that point that this is an exceptional story in some ways, but this is not an exception. So that what we know from Bessie's story, what we know from the story of other women I've looked at, is that this is happening across Australia at the same time. A very dramatic understanding of the way that you wage a struggle. Okay. One of the things that happened to me as a consequence of this, I was still teaching history, and I was unfortunately, involved in what was known in the early 2000s as the history war debate. And one night on Philip Adams' Late Night Live, I was involved in a debate with, I suppose, all the protagonists, Keith Windschuttle, particularly on one side, Professor Stuart McIntyre from Melbourne University on the other, and then people like Don Watson were there telling some great jokes, which tried to inject a bit of humour into the night, which didn't quite work. But I felt by the end of the night that it was one of these debates that seemed to go around in circles and be an argument about sort of footnotes and really didn't get to the emotional character of the story that I found in the work that I had done. And I'd been writing and publishing poetry for about 20 years, and I decided to, in a sense, take some of the language that I'd found and write a narrative poem or produce a narrative poem out of it. And what I did, I wrote this poem, A Footnote to a History War, and in this poem what I did was I wrote 10 pieces where, in fact, they are pieces that range from the voice of what we might call the government and the response, or the respondents being Aboriginal people. And while I say it's 10 poems, don't be alarmed. I think anyone who reads poetry for more than 5 minutes is asking a lot of an audience. These are very short, very formal pieces, which will give you, I think, a clear sense of what I was trying to do was to capture more a voice of the time, and particularly the voice of those Aboriginal people, such as Bessie, who were writing. So this is Footnote to a History War. 1. They are nearer white than half-caste and are but idle bodies. Irresponsible, hopeless and worthless, they are a drain on our goodwill. Insolent and defiant, they will not respond to our kindness or our care. 2. We are sorry to trouble your souls with our sickness. We suffer influenza, typhoid and sores. We suffer, amen. Also, we are late to wish you respectfully a most happy new year. Better late than never. 3. Here is one pure Aboriginal man of good behaviour. He carries a rancid leg. Its cure is medicinal and regular ration. He is sober and steady, a good working man for a hard working day who carries a rancid leg. 4. My colour debars me. My child is dead and I am lost. We are broken into parts, our home left in the wind, and it grows cold here. My wife is Aborigine. I am half-caste, and I am, sir, dutifully yours. I await your response. 5. He wears a suit, issue number 6, hat, issue number 7, and possesses one pair of blankets. She has on loan one mullet net and 2 perch nets. The children are gone. 1 pneumonia, 1 influenza, 1 ditto. 6. I am nearly bootless, and my colour is a curse. I am too white, too dark. I am to be recommended within Unit 4, Subfile 3, for license renewal. I am to be approved by you, by Certificate Number 71, herewith in this body, within me. 7. In the name of the Lord, we are servants of Christ, called as apostles to him. Praise be the Lord and the gospel of God, the word of the testament. Brothers and sisters of the dark races, at prayer with Christ, become pure in the Lord. Amen. 8. We are in need of a flannel, blankets, towel, hat and wire. One shirt white, one trousers working, one tweed suit. Needle and cotton, one dress, one underwear. We are, of course, obliged. 9. I have to report half-caste child, 5 years of age, passed away. 3 o'clock it was just yesterday. Whooping cough, cerebral phlegm and bronchitis. She died in the service of His Majesty. I seek with words your gratitude and kindness to see my wife, my children, across the still water. I seek to touch my daughter's skin and heart. I seek only this from you. Okay, that last stanza, to give you a sense of what I was doing, it's a terrible story of an Aboriginal man who had been reclassified as white just before the Second World War. And probably one of the things that might be instructive here in the sense of the struggle for human rights, and people often ask questions, well, how does a person identify as Aboriginal? And there's obviously, I think often with that question, a suspect notion directed at the Aboriginal person. It's probably important to notice a wonderful historian, Peter Reid, wrote once, if you're an Aboriginal person born in the year 1900 and you live to 60, which would have been very old in those days for an Aboriginal person, your identity would have been changed officially by government approximately 10 times. So non-Aboriginal governments have often played with Aboriginal identity, not Aboriginal people so much. But in this case, it's a terrible example. This man had been born at Lake Tyers, so he was born there. He was born as an Aboriginal man, and then during the Great Depression, when there was a piece of legislation introduced into the Parliament, he, as a so-called mixed-blood person, was reclassified as a non-Aboriginal person. Now, he volunteered for the Second World War, as many Aboriginal men did, and died. There are Aboriginal war dead in France from the First World War. Aboriginal men and women serving in the armed forces in Second World War. While he was away at war, he left as a volunteer from his reserve, and then when he went back to the reserve to see his own children, he was debarred from entering the reserve and told he could not enter an Aboriginal reserve as he was a non-Aboriginal person. He did write that letter asking could he see his children, and they denied him. He wrote a second letter saying, can you bring my children to one side of the lake, the reserve side, and I can stand on the other side and at least let me see my children. They denied him again. So he trespassed on where he was born, and he was charged with trespass and received 3 months jail. Now, what I do in that work is quite deliberate, is to try and bring some heart to a debate which I felt had lost that, and to give some feeling to that debate. Now, the other thing that I will read, and I'll just read one excerpt of this. I've always been interested and have done a lot of writing on, I think probably if there's one Aboriginal person in 19th century Victoria who we could say is a leader for Aboriginal rights, it would be William Barak. William Barak is a remarkable person who, when John Batman arrived at what became Port Phillip in 1835, William Barak was a 12-year-old boy, and he saw this attempted ceremony and signing over of Aboriginal land. He witnessed that, and he lived to see Federation. So he was alive when the first Parliament was held at the Exhibition Buildings here in Melbourne. So he saw great change over his life. He attempted to negotiate with colonial governments for the survival of Aboriginal people. And in a sense, he was a man of great wisdom who understood the power of this coming society, and how could he negotiate a way through for Aboriginal people to remain a viable community. And he did that with great skills as a negotiator. He was also a great artist and a true intellectual. One of the things that really is so upsetting about William Barak, for all his accommodation of non-Aboriginal society, is how poorly he was treated often. And in one telling example, one of his sons, David, was suffering from tuberculosis, and William made a plea to take his son to the Melbourne Hospital, which was then in Lonsdale Street, the Queen Vic Hospital in Lonsdale Street. And he ended up being dropped at the outskirts of the city and carried his son through the streets of the city in the night, and his son eventually died in hospital and was not allowed to see his father. When Aboriginal children were taken into public hospitals, their family couldn't see them at all. Now, I knew that story, and I read an inquiry into the Coranderrk Reserve where William lived in 1881, and what struck me about it was that I read William's testimony. And the people questioning William Barak, I think they treated him like a child in that questioning. They asked him many banal bureaucratic questions. No one asked him about his son. No one asked him about what he'd experienced. And to me, it was one of those telling examples of someone being treated less than human, particularly when they had accommodated people in such a way. So this is a long poem. And again, when I say long poem, I'm not going to read it all. The True History of Barak, William Barak, that I wrote as part of this, what I call the archive series. But I'm going to read you one excerpt, which is a prose poem, which again, I wanted to get people to focus on what was not said at that inquiry. So this section is called Corranderk 1881. And so William was put on a coach for Melbourne, carrying his son David in his arms. When they arrived at Richmond, they were left to themselves in the dark and cool late in the night. William arrived with nothing. He was left with nothing. He carried the boy to his heart through the streets where the heavy brick and stone denied the footsteps of William's father and the footsteps of his own childhood. David clung to his father. William's love stayed with his son until he fell. And when the boy was dead, William returned to Corranderk alone. He arrived home to the manager's welcome of dry bread, weak tea and the Bible. In the following year, William appeared before the governors. He told them the story of his own people. He told the story of his loved son, David. When his testimony had ended, all that they could bother to ask these somber-suited civil servants was this a wild country when you were born? Are you too old for work? And do you have undershirts provided each year? William did not know his age, but was sure that he had worked hard for these men, all to build his own house of freedom. His wife was dead, his son dead. The protectors knew nothing of the boy who was now with William, David's skin with William's skin. His name murmured a song on William's lips, his spirit ebbing through the body of his father. Okay, so in both of those instances, what I'm trying to do as a writer is work with and give voice to Aboriginal people whose voices have been forgotten or denied. And just to give you a telling example of this, again, with Bessie Rowling's story, there's acres of this material for people to read. And yet, when in 1997 the Bringing Them Home report was released by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, there were people making claims that these Aboriginal women, they never wanted their children. They gave up their children willingly. They never struggled to have their children return. And yet the telling evidence, the same sort of evidence that we value as historians, you know, archival, hard-nosed research, in fact would show nothing more opposite than what we've witnessed. So my point here is that what is so sometimes difficult about these issues is that when people make claims against Aboriginal people in this way, it is not difficult to refute it, and it's not difficult to find evidence in any that would stand up to any scrutiny to show that what people are saying is sometimes quite malicious. Now, to finish formally, this is the novel Blood, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. In this, I just want to read a very short section because it was to give, in a sense, I've done a lot of work on Aboriginal places of spirituality, and one of the places I've worked on extensively for 20 years now is Bunjil Shelter, which is the most significant Aboriginal rock art shelter in Victoria. And I wrote my first academic essay on this work in the early 90s, and I continue to do academic work on it since. But again, in this little excerpt, I wanted to give some sense of its meaning today, its very contemporary meaning. And one of the things about this, what sometimes is called a creation story, but certainly a story of great spiritual significance, is Bunjil Shelter, and the story that it tells is about the protection of children. It's about taking care of children. So when I wanted to write this novel and I have these two children in very grave danger in a very contemporary Australia and Victoria, I thought I want to give some resonance to these children feeling and articulating that sense of protection that is offered by this shelter. And just to contextualise the two pages, these two children have just escaped two very dangerous men. Well, one of them's, well, two very dangerous men, I won't give that away, two very dangerous men, and they find shelter. It's very wet, it's very cold. They run into the bush and find shelter in what they only can tell is a cave in the dark night. They know nothing more than they're dry and they're out of harm's way. So then I wanted to give a sense of what protection was given to them by finding that shelter. And this is Jesse, the 13-year-old boy who's the narrator of this book. I woke up early in the morning, my face pushed against the floor of a cave. I freed an arm from underneath me, shoved my hand down the front of my pants and felt the roll of notes. It was still there. I sat up and touched my forehead with my left eye. It felt swollen and crusted with dry blood. I looked across at Rachel. She was lying with her eyes wide open, looking up at the roof of the cave. I followed her eyes. There was a drawing of a fat-bellied man with a small head and two small animals standing next to him. "See the picture," she said. "What do you think it is?" "I don't know. It looks old, though." She pointed at one of the animals. "This one is a dog." "Maybe. Your eye's all black, Jesse, and there's a cut on it. You better wash it or you'll get poisoned." I got Rachel to pour some water into my cupped hands and splashed it over my face and tried rubbing the dried blood away. "Is it gone?" "Not all of it. Let me do it." She poured more water onto the dirty singlet she was wearing, stood in front of me and dabbed at the swollen cut while I stared at her belly button. "The black eye's still there, but it's cleaner," she said. Our clothes weren't exactly dry, but we put them on anyway. We spread the rug out on the cave floor, ate a packet of chips each and finished off the orange juice. Rachel looked up at the painting again while she was eating. "Do you think it means something, this picture?" "Yeah, it means we better take off or a man and a pair of crazy dogs is going to come and chase us." I put the leftover food in the backpack, rolled up the picnic rug, tied it and handed it to Rachel. She tucked it under her arm. "Where are we going?" "I don't know, but we have to get back to the road and take a look. I'll make up my mind then." "Won't that get us into trouble because of..." "We couldn't be in much more trouble. Come on, let's go and take a look." We walked along the narrow path away from the cave. The climb was steep and tired us out. I looked across at Rachel every few steps, wondering when she would start complaining. She only asked me to stop when she saw a sign on the side of the track. It told the story of the painting in the cave and how Aboriginal spirits had made the land. One of the spirits went into the sky and became an eagle, while another turned himself and his family into the night stars to protect the earth, so the sign said. Rachel read aloud as she ran a finger over the words. She was a better reader than me. "I like this bit, Jesse," she said. "It says, guests should obey his laws and know that they must always care for the children. That's us. We're going to be taken care of." I looked up at the empty sky, hoping that the eagle was up there somewhere looking out for us. Okay. Now, that's only two pages of a much longer book, but I suppose to close my part as a writer, I teach writing and have taught it for a long time now, and I always say to students that every writer should possess a code of ethics. And sometimes you'll read writers who say, "I'll write what I like and, you know, publish and be damned." And I always say to my students, "Well, that's a code. It's just a really lousy one." So I asked them to write just one sentence. What do you think your ethical standpoint should be? And for me, it's that never to misrepresent. Never to misrepresent. And even if my characters may be bad, I still wouldn't misrepresent them. I want to be true to the characters that I write about. And relationship to the doing this work on Aboriginal people and on Aboriginal community in Victoria is not only to not misrepresent, but to give people another view as or another way of seeing, to quote John Berger. I was coming back from the Miles Franklin Award on Sunday with my wife. We were flying back from Brisbane, and I read an article about writing and about politics in writing. And the writer was saying, well, we may not think that, yeah, we ask that question, how political is it? She said, I don't even worry about the question. What I think is, if you want to write great art, and I'm not suggesting I make great art, you should write with a big heart. And when I read that, I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. I don't want to write with cool detachment. I don't want to write it clinically. I want to write with a big heart. So for me, when people read my work and get that sort of response, which is often that response that it touched them, I feel that I've been successful. The other thing that's said about my work sometimes that is occasionally bleak. I actually don't think it is. I do like to deal with people on the margins. I do like to deal with conflict and complex issues because they're the issues that I want solved. They're the issues that I want tackled. I like a happy ending, particularly when I watch films, and sometimes I want that joy of something that just gives you that happiness. But for me as a writer, it's not enough for me to do that. I want to tackle issues that ask people to engage with conflict and complexity and find ways through it. Okay, so thank you very much. Now, as was said, it isn't being talked at, it is talking with, and we want to get you to ask questions or have some conversation for about 15 minutes. I know it is apparently cold out, but it's nearly half past. We'll make sure we're out of here by 7:45. So we would love people to ask questions or make comments or if there's anything you want to share with us. So, and we have a roving mic. So who wants to go first up? Look, easy, can't wait.